Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And as you know, because you're listening, every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about my favorite subject, taste. Actually, this is the penultimate conversation we'll be having this season. Next week is our last show for the summer. We'll be back in the fall. And we're going out with a bang, let's say. My guest today is someone who, I hate to say it, needs no introduction. If you're listening, I know you've read something she's written, probably many, many things she's written, whether it's her wonderful articles, her insightful early restaurant reviews, her memoirs, or her forthcoming book coming out May 6th, Delicious, which is a novel. Please welcome Ruth Reichel to Taste Matters. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here.
So, a novel. Oh my goodness! I in doing some reading about how the book came to be, I noticed you said that it has been had been a goal of yours as a writer always to go into fiction, and I just wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. How? Why?
I grew up in publishing. Sure. I mean, my father was a book designer, and he really believed that fiction was the greatest calling. I mean, you know, if there was a religion in my house, it was fiction.
Funny, I mean, that's changed a little bit, hasn't it? I mean, in publishing, you see people are desperate for nonfiction. I know people who adamantly won't read fiction for some reason. I don't understand. Has it changed? Has its place changed?
God, not in my head.
Okay, good. Mine either, but you do see people who react oddly to it. I don't know why. Maybe because so much of nonfiction is fiction these days.
It might be that. You know, I mean, maybe it's the rise of television and movies, but, you know, my father came to this country. He was 26 years old. He came in 1926. He'd always, I mean, he had worked in publishing in Germany. He brought Kafka with him, determined to bring Kafka to America. I mean, and his first self-publishing venture was Flaubert.
So I get it.
And you know, my father designed the American edition of Ulysses. So I come to this with a background, and all of my parents' friends were in publishing. I mean, I grew up in the village. Two blocks from the James Beard House. And, you know, I mean, I thought that's what everybody did.
So that could be a lot of pressure, Ulysses, Flaubert, as someone who wants to write a book. It took you some time to come to fiction, although I imagine you've been writing throughout the time we know you through nonfiction. But how did you, what moved you to cross over now?
You know, when I first met MFK Fisher, she talked to me about how she always wanted, you know, she also, you know, we knew all these people in common in publishing. And she said, you know, of course, the only thing that really matters is fiction. And I've always wanted to write fiction. And she said, and I couldn't do it. Mm. And I thought, God, you know, if Mary Frances can't do it, who am I to think I can do it? Right. But I always thought I should try. And part of it is, you know, after Gourmet closed, my way of going through life is when you're faced with a problem, do the hardest thing. Do the thing you don't know if you can do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I started writing restaurant reviews, I didn't know if I could do it. When I got Gourmet, it was like, you know, how am I don't know how to edit a magazine, but well, this will be interesting. So it was like, what's the hardest thing I can think of to do right now? I'm going to try and write fiction.
So let's... It's funny. It's a hard, in thinking about and preparing for this interview, I read the book, obviously, and it was great. There are elements that seem nonfiction-y, although knowing you, I know they are fiction, but there's a young woman who works at a magazine, a food magazine, that closes, right, yeah. Unexpectedly, all those sorts of things. But how... Talk to me about the process a little bit, I guess, because I think that people don't understand why it's so hard. If you have no aspirations to write, or you write just in your work or whatever, but without a writerly state of mind, fiction seems easy. You're just making up stories. Tell me a little bit about the process for you.
The truth is that with memoir, all you really have to do is decide which pieces are you going to take. You know, which are the most interesting pieces. So to me, writing memoir is almost like talking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you sit down with someone at a dinner table and you edit to make it the most interesting story you can. But it's all given. With fiction, you really have to get to know your characters. Mm-hmm. And to me, all I can say is I think of it as a kind of magic. You sit there waiting for them to come to you, and you can't force it. You can pretty much force nonfiction.
Right. Even if you're making parts up. there's a structure for them some way. The world is not your oyster. There's a story you're telling. Interesting.
Yeah, and with this book, I mean, what I actually found, and I really didn't know how to do it, so I pretty much wrote a book and threw it out.
I
didn't mean to do that, but I realized that I needed to know things that the readers don't need to know, but... The first book was getting to know my characters, and then knowing them, then I could shape the story. But I really had to know them first.
So let's tell people about a few of them. Let's introduce some of your characters. The main protagonist.
The main protagonist is a young woman named Billie Breslin, and all we really know about her is that she's in emotional trouble. She comes to New York, and she gets a job with a magazine called Delicious. Mm-hmm. I think of Billie as the anti-Ruth. I mean, she is so not me. I mean, part of it was I decided to do a young woman.
Right.
I decided to do a woman who, I mean, she's very much not like me. I mean, she's shy.
Right.
She has absolutely no self-confidence at all.
Right.
She has a sister. I've never had a sister.
I mean, why not? If you're going to make it up, let's really play. You know, let's figure out what this would be like. It seems like a great opportunity to take, especially after some wonderful memoir, let's say. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I wanted to do, was I really wanted to totally invent a character. But I put her in a world that I love, the world of food. I mean, I really think that food people are remarkably generous, and I wanted to put her, this troubled person, in this world.
And she has a unique gift, I think, that sort of makes her move her way through. Tell us about the gift.
She is, I mean, people always say, you know, if you could have a superpower, what would your superpower be? And, you know, in my line of work, I've always thought, what if you could just, if you had perfect taste pitch, if you could taste anything and instantly know exactly what was in it? And so I gave her this power of, you know, just being able to taste, and all of the elements are very clear to her. And she's honed that. I mean, she's trained herself. As a child, she went and she spent a lot of time in the spice cupboard sniffing out each spice and memorizing those aromas and those flavors. But, I mean, she is a remarkable cook, and it's a talent that she was born with. And, of course, it's a talent I wish I had been born with.
Right. and one she chooses not to use, which becomes part of the tension in the book a little bit, right, because of her emotional trauma, let's say.
She then becomes phobic, and she can't cook anymore. And she still has this remarkable ability. So when she goes to work at Delicious, they all realize, and she spends time in the test kitchen, and they all realize, oh my God, she's got this amazing ability. Why doesn't she cook?
Right.
And she won't say why she doesn't cook. And she can't even talk about it. But There's clearly some terrible mystery in her background. And then she meets the other great character. Well, there are a lot...
James Beard is one of the great characters in this book, which is what first attracted it to me on my desk. Obviously, your name was there, but I thought, oh, my God, Beard is here. But let's talk about the other great character, besides the larger-than-life one.
Yeah. Well, there is a little girl, and what happens is Billy finds this trove of letters that were written to James Beard by a little girl in Akron, Ohio, during World War II. And she, her mother, her father's in the war, her mother is working in an airplane plant, and she is trying to cook for her mother. And she is using all these, ration recipes, which are horrendous. And I mean, that really came out of, I had the great good fortune of finding a whole pack of, in a thrift store, things that were written by the Department of Agriculture during World War II. So it was recipes for rationing, how to plant a victory garden, and things about the Women's Land Army, which I'd never heard of, and the Crop Conservation Corps. So I had all of this sort of in the back of my mind, and it was a very unconscious thing. I mean, there was this moment after Gourmet closed, where the first thing I did was go and lock the library, because the Gourmet library was it was just an office, an ordinary office room.
Right, the physical
The physical room. But every cookbook that was published starting in 1941 came through Gourmet, and because there wasn't much space, it had been curated and culled down. So it was like a perfect library of every really worthwhile book.
And curated from that time, not from someone going back and making a collection, which must have been be unique, I would think. A lot of libraries have come together after the fact, let's say.
This is like a constantly curated, because there wasn't a lot of space.
Right.
And so, as like a great Chinese book comes out, one of the less good ones is gotten rid of. So I thought this is like a really remarkable this is a treasure trove for someone, and I want to make sure that nobody is coming and filching any books from here once we're all gone. So I locked it, and in fact Roseanne Gold bought that library and donated it to NYU.
Okay.
But so I went in to one last look at the library and found a file case with all these letters that had been written to Gourmet. They were pretty boring letters.
Yeah,
they were like letters, complaining about recipes or asking for recipes. They weren't interesting. But I had one of those little epiphanies that you sometimes get when you're a writer, and I imagined, what if this library were a fabulous, Victorian room, huge, and with this golden light coming in, and what if I had found a bunch of letters that had been written to James Beard, who did write for the magazine in the 40s.
And who did sort of gather people. I love the way you hear him in the letters that are written to him somehow, because he was so, he was always just chatty. He was everyone's friend who sort of reached out, and you knew him. So you captured that somehow, I feel like, very well.
And I imagine that had this little girl written to him, he would have been incredibly generous. And she is like this feisty survivor and very curious. And so you hear a lot about the war and about James Beard through her. And I imagine that if I'd gotten those letters, I would have answered them for sure.
Right.
And she's basically saying, the first letter says to him, dear James Beard, this is who I am. I live in Akron, Ohio. And I'm trying to cook. And she goes through an actual recipe that I found called liver salmi that is like the most vile sounding thing you've ever heard. And she says she's made this and she just cannot feed it to her mother. So she goes out and buries it in the backyard and makes another dinner, and she knows it's wrong. And then she ends it by saying, don't you think you should write a book for people like me who are trying to learn to cook? And that's her sort of constant theme with him over the years is, give me a recipe. I've found this. What do I do with that?
And how to boil water. I mean, he wrote a recipe for how to boil water. Okay. So for sure, he would be interested in that pursuit. So there's one other character there's many other characters, and I think New York City obviously plays a huge role, as it often does in these sorts of things, but it isn't, what's interesting to me is it's not a book about the foodie culture that people are jumping around in Brooklyn with their axes and their beards and tattoos talking about. It's a little bit of a time that seems now, but before now, in the same way. And the character, let's talk about our Italian friend in the book, who we all want to know, and we feel like we've all shopped there. But
yeah, I mean, this is it's this fabulous Italian shop, which is closest probably to De Palos, where I've been shopping my entire life. And there's a character named Sal, who is, he's kind of, for me, a cross between Daryl Cordy and Lou DiPaolo. Okay. I mean, knows everything about Italian food, is incredibly generous with his knowledge, loves his life. I mean, you kind of want to be Sal.
Right.
I mean, he's just, he's happy inside his own skin, loves his work, loves his customers, loves his wife.
Gets them in a way that you don't expect to be gotten as a customer in those places in some instances, I think.
Yeah.
That knowing interaction, even though we're all just playing this game, is the touching part of the relationships he has. I think that's very lovely.
Yeah, and he wants to, he says, you know, it's slow in there and people complain. And he says, look, you can go buy cheese anywhere. But, you know, this is about community,
right,
really. And you know, he said, I'm sure we could work faster and I could make more money, but I wouldn't enjoy it nearly as much. And, you know, this is my life and I want to enjoy my life and I want to enjoy the people I get to meet. And Billy wanders into Sal's path and he sort of takes her, he and his wonderful wife, Rosalie, take her under their wing and become kind of surrogate parents for her in New York and worry about her as only Italian mm-hmm. parents can. And then she has a moment of kind of betraying them. And you know, there's this where she, in the betraying them, sort of understands finally their values and what they are. And, you know, it's this kind of tension between ambition and enjoying your life.
We are going to take a quick break. I'm talking with Ruth Reichel, who is most recently the author of Delicious, which will be out May 6th in stores, a new novel about a young woman at a magazine in New York, a food magazine in New York City. You're listening to Taste Matters. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Ruth Reichel, whose new novel, Delicious, follows the story of a young woman who left, who works at a food magazine called Delicious that closes, and it leads to some adventures in her life. Let's talk a little bit, let's get outside the book and talk about the food world, which you have seen in change in so many profound ways to this point where we are now, where no one quite knows what media is, and yet everyone is so excited about food, and chefs are cooking great things in places that James Beard might not have ever imagined there'd be great restaurants in across America. What do you think of it? Like what? How do you process where we are today? Because people, as you said earlier, don't always remember where we came from or things that happened. Just give me your read on what's going on today.
You know, I've always felt that we were backward, and that now, you know, people say it's like too much, and I think not at all. We're now getting to the place where any mature culture should be, where food is central to what people think about. And, you know, I mean, I think about someone like James Beard, who lived in this time when he was kind of crying in the wilderness, pay attention.
You don't know what you're going to be missing, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And who, unlike so many other people in especially New York, which was then, you know, the very center of food culture, he looked east, he looked both to Europe and to Asia. I mean, he looked both ways. He sort of was the original American who understood what we had here. And, we have always had these great products and the ability to create great food. And now we're finally doing it, and we're finally understanding. The Chinese, the French, the Italians have always understood that you can't be a really great culture unless you're really concerned about how your citizens are fed, and unless you understand that food is and cooking are as important as music and art. I mean, they all go into making a rounded life, and I feel like he would be just thrilled to be alive.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I do too. And I'm going to ask you a very pointed question, because as many people listening know, we're working on this project to create the American Pavilion at the next World's Fair in Milan, which is the theme of the whole fair is food, and we're trying to figure out what American cuisine is. And I got to ask you, like, what do you think is our unique contribution to the world of food, to the great histories of France and Italy and China and Japan? That is distinctly American. You're someone who's seen it from both coasts over many decades.
Well, fusion is like a bad word, but I mean, you want to call it the Columbian
freedom.
Exchange
or
whatever.
Right.
But I mean, the very fact that we did not start anchored in any one cuisine, the fact that we are a nation of immigrants, the fact that we change so easily and so quickly, is that that's our strength. I mean, our strength is that we borrow from all of these immigrant communities who come through, and that we quickly make them American. Mm-hmm. So, and that we never stop doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas almost every other culture has been kind of jingoistic about their food. You know, this is French food, this
our
is Thai food,
this
is
right,
and we don't do that. I mean, we really, we understand that we had a moment of tuna noodle casseroles that was embarrassing. And that, once we finally said, wait a minute, that's really not what American food is. It is not, this bland industrialized stuff, but it's really the fact that We can absorb Korean and Pakistani and French and Italian and take all these spices. And, you know, what's happening is the rest of the world is now sort of catching up and starting to pay attention to all of these other flavors.
And at the same time that that's a strength, I wonder if you see any weakness. And I ask that also because one of the challenges, I think, in some of the food system challenges we have, some of the obesity issues and other public health things related to food, is that without that anchor, somehow we're floating alone and susceptible to some things. And do you agree or disagree?
I totally disagree. Okay. I mean, I think that every culture is susceptible to those if they allow their children to be marketed to. Mm. I mean, I think you can put the onus squarely on industrialized food and the fact that, I mean, I truly believe that eating is learned behavior. And if you teach your children to eat junk at the age of two and you allow them to absorb all the kind of fast food ideas about food, it's very hard to come back from it. And I think, you know, you've got a population of kids that are just sitting ducks for they're marketed to. I think it has nothing to do with, you know, this wonderful banquet of international banquet of flavors that we have.
So you did so much when you were at Gourmet to bring these issues, some of the issues that now seem so natural because everyone's talking about them. But at the time, I think people were surprised to read a food magazine that dealt with questions about sustainable production or how we raise our animals or what we do with lobsters, let's say. Where do you see that those stories playing out these days in the years since then?
You know, it breaks my heart that there isn't, that the Epicurean magazines aren't dealing with these issues. I mean, when David Foster Wallace, he and I had a huge fight about the editing of that piece. And at one point he said, I'm going to pull the piece. And I said, you can. I mean, anybody will publish Consider the Lobster. It's a brilliant piece of writing. But if you want to talk to the people who are cooking those lobsters, you will not give it to the New Yorker. You will keep it in Gourmet. And now what's happened is all those serious food pieces, I mean, they're still being done. They're being done in the New Yorker and the Atlantic and in the New York Times and so forth, in Mother Joan. But they're not being done in the Epicurean magazines. And I think it's really a shame. And there's still so much. Mm-hmm. There are so many issues still to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And none of the Epicurean magazines are addressing them.
And we find at the Beard Foundation, the chefs are interested. And they believe that when they help lead their clients, the clientele are interested. But I wonder why. I mean, it sounds like it's irresponsible of the Epicurean magazines not to deal.
Well, it comes back to advertising again. You know, I mean, the pressure not to publish really serious articles. It's so much easier for your publisher to get an ad in something about, you know, a nice trip through the Italian countryside than it is to get advertising in an article about, you know, the problems with fish farming. You know, the pressure is constantly there to just do the easy stuff. Don't tackle. And also, you know, I mean, when, you know, Barry Esterbrook did the piece on tomato pickers in Florida, it's expensive. You know, you send someone, you know, send them down to Florida for a month to, and, you know, those investigative pieces they're not cheap.
No, in fact, I mean, the Heart News publications can't seem to afford them any. Every story now comes with the support of some nonprofit agency you've never heard of who's helping to fund that sort of journalism just in every category, not just food.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm on the board of FERN, Food and Environmental Reporting Network, because we need to be supporting these pieces. I mean, we really need. I mean, this is important information that needs to get out there. But investigative journalism is time consuming.
Right, it is. I guess we need to talk about social media. Not a part of. I mean, you have a famous following in social media, but not quite a part of. Billy's life, which would probably be untrue today. I bet there isn't a person at a food magazine who isn't required to post a picture on Instagram or something like that. Let's go there. The last few minutes, yeah.
I mean, I love Twitter, and actually my next book is a cookbook, which will be out in a year, that comes off my Twitter feed.
Oh my gosh, that's cool.
It's like a cookbook diary with the tweet, the diary of what was happening. It's like the year after Gourmet Clothes.
Wow.
And the recipe. But for me, in that year when Gourmet Clothes, when I was really depressed about it, social media was it was so reassuring. I mean, it is a way to reach out to like-minded people and make friends who are all over the world. And you know, I think, you know, the pressure for journalists is relentless. You know, the idea that you have to post six times a day. You know, the idea that, you know, it used to be wonderful when I wrote restaurant reviews. They came out. People went to their newspaper in the morning.
Right.
Now they have all the, you know, the entire food section trickles out.
Right. You never know when you're reading or what you're even reading, honestly, what it appeared in. People ask and you don't know. I mean, I pay attention to who wrote it, but often people don't. It just comes in that thing on your screen.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mostly love, I mean, what computers do for us, connect us. I mean, I love that sense of never being alone anymore. I love that sense of, and I know when I was a kid and I'd go to Europe, you'd be completely disconnected. I mean, I had a terrible car accident in Yugoslavia. My parents didn't even know about it for 2 weeks.
Right, that's amazing. So hard to imagine that time for some people these days, yeah.
But, you know, that's a little bit what the, why I chose to do World War II, because, I mean, the idea of thinking about, you know, these soldiers went off for 4 years. They didn't come home. They didn't Skype. They didn't call.
You looked and prayed. You'd hear something good, positive, and not negative, right?
And you often didn't know for months, you know, if your father, brother, son had, you know, been killed or taken prisoner.
Right.
It was such a different world. And that's part of what I wanted to write about, that we live in an unimaginably different time.
Well, thank you for helping us imagine that time for those of us today who live very much in the now. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, as always. Thanks for coming on the show. I would encourage everyone to run out and buy their copy of Delicious. It is delicious. It's on sale May 6th. You can probably pre-order it today on Amazon. And yes, you can. I know you're off on a whirlwind food tour, so thank you for kicking off a little bit with us, and good luck around as you travel around the country.
Thanks so much. This has been so much fun.
Good. Next week is our last week, and we're welcoming David Sachs, who has helped do his part to try to save the delicatessen, but his newest book is on tastemakers and people who he believes have helped make some of the change that we've talked about on this show, make America a more delicious place. Please tune in. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.